first TV show that was created by and designed for people who grew up on television, and it proved that a live comedy show could work years after the networks had virtually abandoned that format. Although the show's become an institution, it's gone through some pretty rough periods in its 11-year history. Several times it nearly derailed. My guests are Doug Hill and Jeff Weingrad. They're the authors of the book Saturday Night, A Backstage History of Saturday Night Live. It's published by Morrow. They've both written about TV for a variety of publications. Doug Hill is currently a staff writer for TV Guide and has also written for the New York Times. Jeff Weingrad has written about TV for the Soho Weekly News and the New York Post and now edits the celebrity page for Women's World magazine. Their new book again is called Saturday Night, A Backstage History of Saturday Night Live. Welcome both of you to Fresh Air.
Hi.
Thank you.
Can you describe the genesis of the idea, how the idea was started for Saturday Night Live?
Well, it depends on which idea or whose idea you're talking about. Within the network, the president of the network at the time was a man named Herb Schlosser. This is 1975. And he had an idea for a late-night show on Saturday nights that was quite different than what the show that turned out to be Saturday Night Live. He said, we have the Today Show, we have the Tonight Show, let's do a show called Saturday Night. And he commissioned a young programming executive named Dick Ebersol to produce this show. So that was his idea.
You point out that it really is the first show by and for the generation of people that grew up on TV. How unique was that at the time? Was this a completely different population of people working for television?
Yeah, I would say it was fairly unique at the time. It was unique at the time. Lorne Michaels was the creative producer of the show. He is the man who Dick Ebersol went out and hired to create the show. And he had been saying for years, and in fact he had pitched a show at NBC in 1972 that was very similar, and it basically was Saturday Night Live, the same elements of Saturday Night Live, a comedy troupe and sketches and short films and parody commercials and that sort of thing. And Lorne had been formulating the show in his head for years, and he has said that this is a show that really should have been on years before, back in the 60s. And television was not doing this kind of programming. Television was known then for, you know, presenting a rather dishonest face. And the people who were watching television, who grew up through the 60s, really had low regard for it because of this. It was dishonest. And the only show, in a sense, in the prior 4 or 5 years or 6 years before Saturday Night Live that had tried to put present itself in a realistic and an honest way was the Smothers Brothers, and they were squelched for their efforts.
They wanted to really separate themselves from the kind of TV that they thought was really stale. And I guess that one of the initial ideas was to make sure that they didn't hire people who were really associated with TV history.
Yes.
Who are some of the people that were proposed by the network executives that Lorne Michaels, the producer of the show, rejected?
Oh, it was suggested that as the musical guest on the first show, we have the USC Marching Band. Lorne didn't go for that one. Bob Hope was suggested as an early host. Namath and Rich Little. This was the way that the network was thinking in those days. All these people are indicative of the attitude toward comedy, and it was the same old stuff, really, and that wasn't what Saturday Night wanted to be.
In fact, these people not Bob Hope, but Rich Little and Joe Namath were new NBC stars at the time. They had been hired by the network, and this was how the network saw the world of television, and they were proposing to put them on this new show Saturday Night.
In spite of the fact that the people at Saturday Night Live were really trying to separate themselves from their forebears in television, they still had to go talk with Carson and convince him that they weren't going to be trying to steal away his format. What happened at that meeting?
Well, you don't do a new late night show on NBC without going and getting Johnny Carson's okay, really, or at least his sanction. And what happened was that Lorne Michaels and Dick Ebersol were together out in California early on explaining the show to the affiliates at a gathering out there, an affiliates gathering, and they were told that Johnny wanted to see them. And they went out to—they called and made an appointment for the next day. And they went out there to Johnny's office, and they knew that that Johnny had been alerted when. What did he say over the intercom there?
He said, "Send the boys in."
Right.
He knew they were young. He had been told how young they were.
Right.
The funny thing is, over and over again in their meeting, he kept turning to them, and with a sort of a wry smile, he would say, "So you're going to be on one night a week, huh?" Because, of course, Carson's on five nights a week. And he didn't take them too seriously at that time. He was very cordial to them, and they were cordial to him with all due respect. And Carson was concerned that they were going to duplicate his show and that there might be some overlap, so he wanted to make sure that wasn't going to be a problem. Lorne and Ebersole assured him that it wouldn't be a problem, and they left on very cordial terms. It didn't take long for Johnny Carson to decide that he didn't really care for Saturday Night, and over the years he developed a strong distaste for the show.
Was it?
Like most comedians of his generation, he didn't like the show's attitude, and they stood against much of what he stood for.
Yeah, no, I've interviewed a lot of older comedians who really found pretty reprehensible the kind of humor that you saw weekly on Saturday Night.
It's very common among that generation, not only the comedians, but I think the audience of those comedians. A lot of people in what might be called the older generation, what Saturday Night would call it, were very offended. That included the older executives at NBC.
Right.
Yeah, well, what were some of those generational differences like, and aesthetic differences, too, when you have these younger people with a pretty different sensibility than the comedians who were on before them on TV coming into the network? What kind of disputes or differences did they get into, not only with the networks, but with the crew?
Right. They found themselves immediately clashing with the studio crew and wanting to do things in ways that were virtually impossible to do, but they didn't know it. The studio crew referred to the Saturday Night group as the Children's Television Workshop, which is the Sesame Street group. And you know, they would say things, well, let's, you know, flood the studio for this sketch. And, well, you can't do that. Well, then let's just use the chroma key, which is this device, you know, that you see where they can put pictures, run pictures, in a sense, behind people. Well, you know, they had quick answers for things, and they were writing impossible sketches to carry forth on the air, and just found themselves clashing left and right. But also in the style of their humor, in the words that they were using, there were sketches that were, in a sense, responded to in such a way by the crew that they actually would boo that they
during
were
rehearsals.
During rehearsals, just because of the I guess the language that had never been they had never seen before used on television, the topics they were talking about.
And also, the Saturday Night group they weren't polite as they were going about this business. They were very—they were seen as arrogant by the crew and by most of the people within NBC. They were going to do this show, and you people are old fogies and get out of our way is essentially the attitude that was conveyed. And, of course, the old fogies didn't appreciate being treated that way. So there was a lot of tension in the early days.
All the performers who were hired for the original crew of Saturday Night Live were virtually unknown to the American public, aside from people who'd seen them at regional comedy clubs. Was there a pecking order when the first cast was first hired, and were there people who were already picked out to play a certain role within Saturday Night or to really, you know, make it as the star within there?
It wasn't that they were picked and defined so much as that there was sort of, just by the force of their personality, some people emerged as the leaders. They were Chevy Chase and Michael O'Donohue. O'Donohue had been a writer and editor at the National Lampoon and had a very strong reputation in East Coast comedy circles at the time. And they were both a little older than the rest of the group and very strong personalities. And they dominated with Lorne Michaels the show at that time. And some of the younger people were very shy and felt a little stampeded by the stronger, the overpowering personalities, really, of Chevy and Michael O'Donohue.
Yeah, one of the writers commented that Chevy and Lorne and O'Donohue would go off to Elaine's, and everybody else would wait till, which is a night spot in New York, and everybody else would wait till they came back to see what the show was going to be all about. They were definitely the triumvirate on top of the show. And there were a group of writers in the middle, and then there was a group that were the neophytes that sort of came along in later years that came on very strong. And you know, Lorne Michaels set up his team this way, and I feel that he had this in mind where he knew that people would grow through the years. He needed people who were strong on top, but he also wanted to be able to mold people in a certain way. And he hired these people. You talked about the clash with the people at NBC. He didn't want professionals. He wanted people who had never worked on television. Many of his writers, most all of his cast, or virtually all of his cast, had not worked on television. And he didn't want people that were had already bent to the rules and were shaped by rules of television that had come before then. And he wanted people that were enlightened amateurs, as he put it.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Jeff Weingrad and Doug Hill, authors of the new book, Saturday Night. Nevertheless, the guest stars were frequently well-known figures, either from television or probably more frequently from movies. And before the cast was really famous, it was the star that was supposed to be the big attraction. But from the way you describe it, it sounds like the guest host was frequently sabotaged by the crew of Saturday Night.
I'm not sure it was as strong as sabotage, but there was a very the Saturday Night team, the staff, became a very closely knit team, and it was a very tight group that if you didn't fit in, you were often shut out very distinctly. And several of the hosts we talked to said that it was quite unpleasant to Madeline Kahn, for example, told us that she felt like the new kid at high school who was not accepted by the in-team. Others were embraced, of course, but it was basically you had, as one of the production assistants said to us, you either went along or found yourself, shut out.
Didn't people like Belushi sometimes take out the guest host on drinking binges that Belushi could handle and the guest host couldn't?
Yeah, that was a favorite. I don't know what to call it, a trick. I mean, that was just the way John was. And he would go out partying, and if he found a host that was a compadre spirit, he'd take him along all week. And by Saturday night, the host was usually so wasted he had real trouble on the air. And John, meanwhile, went through this every week, and he'd get himself a massage and get himself all psyched up for air. He'd drag himself through dress, and usually John Belushi in dress was not anything spectacular, but come airtime, he just sort of peaked for air and always got himself, or usually got himself together for airtime. But often it was the host that was left with his eyes real droopy.
Were there any hosts who talked about that in particular?
Well, people talked about Gary Busey as being one who was a victim of that in particular. He partied with John for several nights, and by showtime, he was pretty crazed. He disappeared right before showtime. They almost couldn't find him. They had to conduct a frantic search for him.
Right.
Leading up to a minute before the show went on live.
Yeah, they sent people scurrying all around the studio to find Gary Busey, and somebody went racing by Jane Curtin and said, Jane, did you see Gary? And she said, I think he went out for pizza.
Yeah. I think the argument could be made that this happened with the Rolling Stones.
Yes, it could.
You think could not be possibly out-partied, but when the Rolling Stones hosted the premiere show of the fourth season, Saturday Night, and specifically John, partied with the Stones all week long, and the Stones were rehearsing in this Midtown rehearsal studio, and it was just a great, rock and roll week, and they were all having a great time. But when it came to the air show, the Stones had burned themselves out. Mick's voice seemed to be gone, and they just didn't come across on air, and Saturday Night, John and Bill Murray were really clicking on that show, and Dan Aykroyd too. And there was a bit of a competition, unstated competition between the Stones and Saturday Night that night, what Paul Schaefer called a battle of the bands, and Saturday Night won, I think.
Huh.
They both the Stones and the show at that time were pretty much at the top of their game, and it was sort of the social cultural icons going head to head,
I know when I interviewed Franken and Davis, two of the writers and sometimes performers on Saturday Night, shortly after they left the program, they said that when they finally got to go on a vacation, they'd wake up in Paris on vacation in a cold sweat, thinking of the night Milton Berle hosted.
Mm.
And in your book, he's also the person that everyone seemed to agree on was the worst guest host that they ever had. That he, some of the things he did horrified them. What was considered so terrible about his guest hosting?
It goes back to what we were talking about earlier, about old television comedy. Milton Berle, it was the old style of television comedy, this sort of shtick, you know, and he just really brought that attitude with him when he came to the show and wouldn't be shaken and wouldn't do anything other than that. He told some offensive racist jokes in his monologue, and he wouldn't make changes that the show wanted to make him change. And
he was mugging all week long, you know,
yeah,
the eyebrows and the cigar. And
say, hey, booby, come here, that sort of stuff. And one of the writers tells this story of going into Milton Berle's dressing room right before the show, and Milton was spray painting the bald spot on the top of his head with something out of an aerosol can. It was, most people on the show consider him to be the most difficult host ever.
It's interesting because he kind of exemplified a certain type of comedic live breakthrough on television. And at the same time, he really embarrassed the heck out of everybody on Saturday Night.
Yeah, well, it was an attitude thing. And a couple of people mentioned to us, he came on the show and spent that whole week there with an attitude that I am Mr. Television,
mm-hmm.
not I was Mr.
Yes,
Television.
And that was the key.
And by the end of the show, the last few minutes of the show was Milton Berle standing on stage singing September song and talking about, you know, in a very philosophical
these are precious days, ladies
yes,
and gentlemen.
Right, and then there was a not so spontaneous standing ovation, which was led by, you know, some of his people in the audience. And Lorne Michaels, who was watching this thing from the control room, was at night downing more than his usual one or two glasses of wine and looking grayer and grayer as it went on. And literally, as the show went off the air, he turned to nobody in general in the control room and just said that was the worst show ever.
I think he said it to the director, Wilson. Yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Jeff Weingrad and Doug Hill, co-authors of the new book Saturday Night, which is a behind-the-scenes history of Saturday Night Live. You talk about a lot of difficulties that some of the women performers and writers had, just creating space for themselves and having to insist that they get parts on stage and that the sketches that they wrote got accepted. What were more specifically some of the problems that the women actors and writers had?
Just being heard was one of the main problems they had in meetings, and in the meetings where the lineup for the show would be decided. It was a tough crew on Saturday Night. The men were very aggressive, macho kind of guys, and they weren't shy about expressing their opinion, and they talked loudly and forcefully, and the women were uncomfortable and felt that they were being outshouted a lot, and they felt that they had to fight to have their own voice in the show. And often it was just a matter of in a read-through, when material was being tried out, the men would chortle and laugh very loudly at their own material, and then they would sort of sit on their hands when the women's stuff was read, and it wasn't chosen. The women give credit to Lorne Michaels, the producer, for being sensitive to that and being sensitive to the sorts of things that they were writing, so that there was some balancing force there. But nonetheless, there was a lot of sound and fury from the men.
You said that Belushi especially didn't think that women were funny. Was he particularly difficult for the women to deal with?
Yeah, I would say he was particularly difficult. He was, as some have summed it up, misogynist, and just really seemed to dislike women, and just at times, a number of occasions, demanded that the women writers be fired from the show. And he often refused to participate in their sketches. One of the most famous sketches on the show is the nerd sketch with Bill Murray and Gilda Radner playing these nerdy characters. And that role was written for John, but he just refused to participate because it was written by two of the women writers.
He said he didn't like it. That wasn't the reason he gave, but he just said they were writing bad stuff. Right.
He also had a troubled relationship with Jane Curtin, and the two of them quite often, because she was not a shrinking violet, and they often found themselves in shouting matches.
What were their arguments about?
Well, Jane was the so-called most normal member of the cast, and she was, I mean, by John's terms, she was straight and boring, and he was anything but, and he, I think, would go out of his way to offend her, and he would make sexist remarks to her, and Jane would put up with a certain amount of it, but after a while she got tired of it, and she'd start talking, making remarks back, and they would get in an argument.
Were the women becoming competitive with each other because there were so few parts for the women written in initially?
The answer to that, in a sense, is yes and no. There was a camaraderie just born of the fact that, there were only the three women cast members, and they were always doing things together for a very long period. They were had to share a dressing room. Gilda Radner has joked on a number of occasions that when they left the show, that she expected to be given all three were to share a split a gold watch. And so in that sense, there was a camaraderie about, an us-against-them type camaraderie. But on the other hand, Gilda and Lorraine often found themselves in competition for parts. And also, Gilda really was a much bigger star than Lorraine, and it would hurt Lorraine to sit and have to watch all the adulation and success that Gilda was achieving. And it made for, at times, a difficult relationship between those two. And, in fact, after a falling out over a certain sketch in the, I think it was the third year, they did not talk to each other for a long period of time.
There was a meeting that the women performers and writers had to see if there was anything that they could do collectively to try to overcome the kind of sexism that they were coming up against. Were they able to resolve anything at that meeting?
No. That was early on, and they had a slumber party, as a matter of fact, to discuss what they could do. And some of the women writers were in favor of forming some sort of coalition, as one called it, to go and talk to Lorne and protest that they weren't getting a fair voice in the show. But the women performers in particular felt that they were too vulnerable to do that because they depended on the men writers. And basically, the slumber party broke up early, and the only decision was that they should all try to be so funny that they were accepted by the strength of their humor.
There were a lot of times that the women were really offended by a very sexist role that was written for them. Could they not perform it? You talk about Jane Curtin having to do lines on Weekend Update when she was anchoring that, some of which she really hated. Couldn't you say, I don't want to do this?
I'm sure.
Or I want to rewrite it?
Yeah, I am sure they did do that. But, there's a point where you have to start saying to yourself, well, I'm a professional and I'm given lines and the show has to go on. And I'm sure that everybody gets saddled with parts that they don't really care for. And some people will voice their opinions more strongly than others. Belushi, walked away from many parts. I'm sure some of the women did too. But because there was such a scarcity of roles for them, of any depth quite often, you don't want to say no too often.
You talk about how Gilda Radner was having problems, it was believed, with bulimia, and Lorraine Newman with anorexia. Is there evidence that that's true, or is that still in the hearsay kind of stages?
We don't have doctor's certificates, but it was believed by the people who worked with them on the show that this was the case, and that it certainly has been acknowledged that there was what appeared to be bulimic or anorectic problems.
Was there pressure on them from the outside, from the people who they worked with, to be really thin, or do you think that was more? You might not know this, or if it was more
I think it was their own psyches more than anything, certainly.
Yeah.
Gilda has often talked about being obsessed as a former, as a fat child. She talks a lot about that, and As performers, they wanted to be thin. Mm-hmm. I don't think there was anybody from NBC saying you must be thin. I think it was their own feelings.
So. Later on, actually, there was some pressure in a subsequent cast for the women to lose weight and were told to go on diets and lose, actually given a certain amount of pounds to lose, but not with Gilda and Lorraine.
Someone else who had problems with the material he was given was Garrett Morris, who you describe as being isolated from the rest of the cast for two reasons. One is that he was the only black member, and the other was that he was 38, and he was over 10 years older than most of the other cast members. Do you think that the writers were having problems writing good material for a black actor? And I should ask you for some examples of what he and many other people found to be pretty... racist.
The basic example is that they kept writing parts for him in which he was to appear in drag, and that happened over and over again. And it stood out because they weren't writing other parts for him. It's very surprising, I think, in retrospect, that for some reason the white writers on that show, and they were white, were unable to deal with black issues and seemingly unwilling. Some of the sketches they wrote for him were very offensive. There was one that didn't make it on the show called the Tar Brush sketch, which was a parody commercial about a toothbrush that darkened black's supposedly white teeth. Right. A bizarre concept to begin with and you know, obviously offensive. Garrett Morris said that some black technicians in the studio walked out when it was rehearsed. They were so offended. And I think Garrett was in the same position that Jeff was alluding to with the women, that, you know, he was getting so few parts that he felt he had to take what he could get. And unfortunately, a lot of those parts were in drag, and it got to be pretty sad after a while.
You want to tell the Cicely Tyson story?
Well, Cicely Tyson was a guest host, and I think it was the end of the third year or the beginning of the fourth year. And... And she did a monologue in which actually the show started with Garrett dressed in drag as Cicely Tyson. And she then came out and said, "Garrett, what are you doing?" And he explained that, you know, when he was told that this was written by the writers, but it's sadly true that he was told that he told Cicely that, well, when he saw that she was hosting, he figured it must be a part for him in drag. And she then berated him, although again this was part of the sketch. It seemed sadly to be right on the mark as far as hitting home about what was going on there. She berated him for taking all these parts in drag and demeaning himself and allowing himself to be used in this way. And and he made a joke about how he gets to keep the clothes. And,
the dresses, yeah.
The dresses. And,
Before the show went on the air, Cicely Tyson came in and they presented her with some material, and she was so offended by the nature of that material that she refused to do it and demanded that they write new material. And I think the attitude was that of a lot of the black community was, you know, Garrett, why aren't you doing that as well?
In his last period of Saturday Night Live, he was starting to have a drug problem and apparently was just really losing it for a while.
Yeah, that was a sad result, at least in some degree, of what we were just talking about, we feel, and or at least I feel. And he did. He began to use cocaine quite heavily and at some point was freebasing it, which is a real strong way of using it, and it caused him to have to at times be losing his mind, and he was totally unreliable to have on the show during this period, and so they wrote less for him. It was a real negative spiraling effect, and it got real bad. He was, you know, they would be fearful that he wouldn't know when to walk in or when to walk out, and
he was hallucinating. At one point, he would talk, during his limousine rides, the drivers would report that he was having conversations with people who weren't there. He would go up to production assistants on the show and tell them that he had seen the production assistant at his apartment. "You're the one," he said to them. In other words, he had acute paranoia and hallucinations.
The many assistants the female assistants were afraid to be around him. He was just.
It was a tragic situation.
Yeah, it was. It was very sad.
Chevy Chase became the first big star of Saturday Night Live, and he was also the first person to leave the series. What effect did it have on the people who he worked with when suddenly he became the star? It was no longer just an ensemble cast. It was this big star, Chevy Chase.
Shocked them. It really, in retrospect, it's funny how naive they were. They have said that that they were naive. They had no expectation that one of them could be pulled out and said this is defined as the star. They were a repertory group. They came out of the the communal ideas of the 60s, more or less, and they had no idea that this could happen. So there was a lot of bitter feelings about it and a lot of surprise.
Chevy didn't help things along when he did break out. He was very egocentric and obnoxious about it and would remind people about how big a star he had become. And quite often in interviews, he would say things that seemed to reflect unkindly on the others or not say things about the others and what their roles were. And there's a part in the book where we talk about Jane Curtin really letting him have it, saying, he was saying I was misquoted, and she pointed out to him in a rather loud tone that, you can get misquoted once and you can get, maybe misquoted twice, but this is ridiculous.
Sounds like when he made this decision to leave, nobody really missed him, nobody from the cast.
I think a lot of people were glad to see him go. Certainly John Belushi was, because Chevy was dominated the show in the first year. He was such a strong writer and such a strong performer. He was getting an awful lot of airtime, and a lot of the other people felt, we want a shot too. So in that sense, yeah, they were glad to see him go.
When he left, Bill Murray was hired to become part of the cast, but I guess they didn't want to bring him in immediately so that he wouldn't have to bear the burden of being Chase's replacement.
Yeah, that's how Lorne Michaels decided to do it, I think on paper it sounds like a good idea. Bring him in slowly and people get used to him. But really what happened, I think, is what would have happened anyway, that people saw him as Chevy's replacement, and some people thought that for some reason he was responsible for it. And he got a lot of mail about it, and he found that he had a lot of difficulties succeeding on air, because the people who had been there before, despite the fact that they knew Bill Murray well, when he did join the show, they weren't about to just bring him up to the same level they were on. He was a year behind and had to work himself in, and he did a lot of second cop roles, as he put it. And when he did have an opportunity to shine, he seemed to fumble the ball here and there. And it really wasn't until the very end of the year that he was able to basically establish the Bill Murray persona that the fans of the show are familiar with or became familiar with.
And it's interesting that he did that himself. He felt that it was necessary for him to fight for his place in the show. And when he finally did break through with this one sketch called the Shower Mic Sketch, it was a sketch that he had written himself. Interestingly enough, the same pattern was repeated quite a few years later with Eddie Murphy, who had to fight in a similar fashion broke through on his own.
I was surprised to read that there were network executives that didn't want to see Murray become one of the performers because they thought his face was too pockmarked.
Yeah. Chevy had these, had the good looks, the white bread good looks that, of a Johnny Carson Midwest sort. And when he left the network being the network, they didn't want, they would have liked to have gotten a Chevy clone. Bill Murray had a much harder edge to him. He had a reputation of being a real rough guy, something of a brawler, and his face was not pretty. They finally went along with Lorne Michaels' decision to hire him, but they really kept reminding Lorne, the network executives kept reminding Lorne, well, if it doesn't work out, it's only really a year and we could change it at the end of the year.
After he did the movie Where the Buffalo Roam, where he played Hunter Thompson, you say he became like Hunter Thompson, and he had been a brawler before, but it really got out of hand. What were some of the things that he did?
Well, it was actually while he was making the movie. It was a real classical case of the role overtaking the actor. And numerous people on the staff say that you just couldn't talk to Bill Murray during this period. He had become Hunter Thompson, and he would literally walk around with the cigarette holder and the dark sunglasses, and he berated the people for the writing on the show quite vehemently, and he was very tough to get along with. When the movie came out, it flopped, and Billy got out of his Hunter Thompson persona. And as one of the writers put it, they were so glad to have Billy back that they never said anything to him about this period, because when someone comes out of a coma, you don't go up and tell them how hard they've been to get along with.
My guests are Doug Hale and Jeff Weingrad, the author of the new book Saturday Night Live, which is a backstage history of Saturday Night Live. There were constant squabbles with the censors. Were the writers expected to defend their own material to the censors?
Well, I don't know that they were expected at when the show first began, but that is what finally took place. That as time went along, the producer Lorne Michaels allowed the writers to deal with the censors. This was unusual in television. Usually, it's the producer, but as the writers started to get stronger, Lorne allowed them to be far more involved in the production of their piece. Not just only writing it, but really almost in a sense producing their pieces. And part of that was fighting the censors. And Franken and Davis, who you mentioned, were your guests at one point here, they were ones who relished fighting with the censors. And they got into some real doozies with the censors.
What was one of the better fights over a sketch? What was one of the sketches that got by the skin of its teeth or got canceled?
One of Franken and Davis's sketches which did get by was called First He Cries, which was a parody of the book by Betty Rollin, First You Cry, which is about her experience with breast cancer and mastectomy. And they did a parody on that, which supposedly portrayed breast cancer from the male point of view. And it was Bill Murray played this husband who was horrified that he was going to have to have a deformed wife. It's tough stuff. The butt of the joke was supposed to be the man, and it was supposed to be kidding male attitudes about women's beauty. But as often happened with Franken and Davis's humor, it was a lot of people took it to mean just the opposite, and one of the reasons it got on the air was because the chief censor's sister, I believe it had undergone a cancer operation, as had
B. Arthur,
that was the host who played in the sketch, her sister also. That's one of the reasons she went along with the sketch. They both regretted it afterwards because it was created a great deal of controversy.
But Betty Rollin did send Al Franken a letter afterwards commending him, or at least saying that, you know, you can satirize anything, really, and she was willing to go along with it.
I thought it was a really funny sketch, and I don't know, I always thought that it was just about what you said, of just satirizing certain male attitudes. But
a lot of people, with Franken Davis came at things from a direction that a lot of people mistook for representing the attitude that they were trying to say was ridiculous.
But that's why TV ends up being so tame, because if 100% of the people don't get the joke, then you can't have it on.
A Franken and Davis sketch that was perhaps more representative of the problems they caused sometimes when they wrote these things was a sketch that didn't get on, which was a sketch that was meant to be a parody of the David Susskind show, in which all the guests were people who were out to assassinate Ted Kennedy. And it was just, he was interviewing them, and everybody was telling how they were going to kill Ted Kennedy. Well, the censors went wild on that. And Franken and Davis did back down on it. I mean, NBC's point of view was that, you know, my God, what happens if somebody looks at this and is inspired by it?
The cast of Saturday Night Live went from being totally unknown to being wildly popular and pretty wealthy, too, especially when movie deals started coming in for some of them. What happened to the spirit behind the scenes when the show became so successful? It won a lot of Emmys. Everybody was famous. Did the atmosphere change?
Fundamentally, yeah. That's one of the predominant themes in the book, I think, that stardom on that level changes people very profoundly. And there had been in the early days much more of a all for one, one for all kind of spirit to the show. And virtually everyone we talked to on the show said that once this stardom came in, that people were, as one of the writers put it, jockeying for a position, looking where they could cash in. And they more or less were divided by this, by the success, I think.
Is this also when drugs started taking more of a toll on everybody? Is it about the same time?
Well, it is about the same time. And the drugs seem to change about the same time, from marijuana to cocaine. There had always been some cocaine around the show, but from the reports that we got, it seemed that about the third or fourth year, which was about the time the show really shifted into high gear, the drug of choice seemed to shift also to cocaine, which it's a higher priced, or, you know, at that point, a more chic type of thing. And I think it sort of also was a point where Saturday Night started to drift away from its audience, because I don't think its audience at that time was necessarily doing a lot of cocaine.
It's interesting to think about these people who wanted so much to get away from TV showbiz aesthetics to suddenly become that in spades themselves, to become really wealthy and have limousines and just all the kind of special, sometimes petty demands that you associate with showbiz stars, and have a little rat pack of their own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think very, very interesting, and in some respects sad. I think it's a little too easy to be sanctimonious about, you know, gee, they let us down, that kind of feeling, only in the sense that I it's very difficult to appreciate how crazy being that famous gets you. And I just think, looking in from the outside, it's hard to appreciate what happens when you are in the inside. But certainly, they weren't outlaws anymore. NBC was giving them anything they wanted, as the world was coming to them, really.
There's a story we tell in the book. You talk about the price of success that they had to pay at times. We tell a story about how Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi were on at a vacation retreat in Wisconsin, trying to get some peace and quiet. And they went to a restaurant, and they went upstairs. The owner of the restaurant told them to be nice and quiet up there. And by the time they were halfway through their meal, they heard the crowd surging up towards the step. It was like up the steps. It was like an old science fiction movie where the monster starts moving up the steps. And they actually were forced to jump out a back window into these prickly bushes and scratching themselves up. And the women that they were with got all these cuts. And it's like they couldn't hide anywhere after their success became so so massive that they couldn't hide anywhere. And it's not easy. It's the transitions they went through, as I see it, are inevitable. And I have the highest regard for those who are able to hold on to their heads and their sensibilities when fame does come to them on that level.
I think that's an important point to note. Some people do withstand it and keep straight heads, and we admire those who can do it greatly. And it is disappointing to some degree to see people lose contact with what might be called the real world. But it's at the same time that it's disappointing, it's also understandable.
When the transition happened and Lorne Michaels left the show, the original producer, and the whole initial cast that remained left the show, what were some of the reasons for their leaving? This was 79 or 80,
this
I forget
was the,
which.
The summer of 1980, between the spring and the fall. Well, most people left because, a number of reasons. They were tired. They had been working very hard for, many years. And they had, every year at the end of the year, it was always a question about who, whether we'd be coming back, whether they'd be coming back or not. But a new producer was hired, and she was not, as Lorne Michaels told one of the NBC executives who hired her, she was not a member of the Saturday Night core group. And the people who, the writers and the many of the production assistants and staff members who I'm sure NBC hoped very much would return, even if Lorne Michaels did not. They didn't want to work with this woman, Jean Demanian, and they did not want to work with her. And so she was all of a sudden put into a position where she had to go out and hire just a brand new staff from top to bottom. There were less than a handful of people who continued with her, and these were people who, you know, didn't have the luxury of saying, "Well, I don't want to work anymore." You know, they had family and responsibilities, and they all actually ran it by Lorne before they did go to work for Gene. And you know, Lorne was gracious and said, "You know, he understands they have to make a living." And but almost everybody did not come back and just didn't want to work for Gene.
What did everyone find so offensive about her?
Well, it was she wasn't offensive to them as a talent coordinator, which is what she was on Lorne's show, but she was secretly hired by NBC when they were all still thinking about, gee, what are we going to do next year? And it was like having their boss and their fearless leader was replaced by this woman, and to them it was a breach of loyalty to go to work for her. And they also had no confidence in her ability to produce a decent show.
She finally assembled the cast of, well, Eddie Murphy and Joe Piscopo, but also Denny Dillon, Gilbert Gottfried.
Gil Mathias.
Anne Risley,
yeah. Charles Rocket.
Right.
Yeah, she hired these people and an entire new staff of writers. And she just was not a woman with a person with a very good sense of humor. Some of the people on the show put it this way, that they said that she was an uptown person, but it was a downtown show. And, you know, she liked to hang around in the chic saloons of New York and dress to the nines and presented herself extremely well, gave a very good picture of what, you know, a producer might look like. But when it came down to the comedy and to the leadership role that was needed, she wasn't up to doing it. She was very inflexible. Some of the people on the show started to call her the Ayatollah Demanian. She was very inflexible and insisted on doing things her way, yet didn't seem to have the experience in the background and the insight to be able to tell people what they were doing wrong, only to tell them they were doing things wrong. And as one of the writers put it, it was her inability to understand her inabilities that led to her having real trouble. She didn't go out and hire somebody to be able to delegate the responsibility.
The shocking thing really was that NBC hired her in the first place. She clearly was not qualified.
It's interesting that after she left, I think the only two people who survived the cast were Joe Piscopo and Eddie Murphy, who went on to be the real big stars of the subsequent year. And that year was a really successful year, and a year full, I think, of some very funny programs. Everybody's shaking their head no here. Yeah. But I thought that year with Tim Kazurinsky and Piscopo and Murphy produced some really very funny stuff.
Certainly, Eddie and Joe produced a lot of funny stuff, and I agree. I like Tim's stuff, too. I think our feeling, and correct me, Jeff, if you don't agree, our feeling was that there were funny moments, but that there wasn't those real peaks that there had been in earlier years.
No, I do agree with that, but I think, in a sense, the time for the show had passed by then. And even though, if you could look at last year's cast, which was very funny, Dick Ebersol, who had come back to produce the show, the network executive who had gotten it off the ground in 1975, came back in 81 to take it over from Gene Demanian. And he assembled some interesting casts. And last year, he got together a group of real comedy professionals. And they were all excellent. And there were some moments on the show that were very, very funny. But the spark and the originality and the real attraction of the show was gone because they had already done it. They had succeeded, and it was sort of like competing with their past success. And it was virtually impossible, no matter how funny they were. It wasn't, and I don't think that it could ever be, you know, the same old thing.
Well, I'd put a lot of the sketches with Billy Crystal in it, and what's his name from SCTV?
Martin Short.
And any day alongside, you know, Chevy Chase reading the news or Falling Down or Gerald Ford jokes, there was a lot of, I think, wouldn't you agree that there was a lot of just really dumb physical comedy and sight gags that first year, and that that it just really might not stand up that well?
Again, I think that watching it, and that I think the first year stuff stands up fine.
Uh-huh.
Yes, it was. There was a lot of dumb, silly stuff, but I think Chevy pulled it off. Certainly, in that time, also, it stood out just by the nature of how different it was.
Yeah, I think that's the key point. It was just so different back in '75, and when Marty Short was doing what he was doing last year so well, tremendously well. It's just that he was doing something that they had, they had blazed this path and established an attitude about comedy, which he was the beneficiary of, and doing it real well.
Well, Martin Short actually brought over at least one of his characters that he had developed for Second
yes,
City TV.
Ed Grimm,
yes. Yeah. Was there always a lot of friction between the Saturday Night Live performers and the SCTV performers, because they were doing some really very similar things?
I don't think there was friction between the performers.
Was there competition between them?
Well, there was more competition on an executive level. At one point, the producer of the show, Dick Ebersol, was hoping to raid the SCTV cast, and SCTV's producer wasn't too happy about that for obvious reasons. So there was friction on that level, but I've never heard anybody say any of the cast members
no.
say anything but great things about each other.
And these people really, they knew each other back many years, John Candy, and they were all, and many of the Saturday Night people, they were in Second City, they were up in Toronto and Chicago, and they knew each other well. They knew what was going on, but it was just the people above them who were doing these things. And at one point, actually, there was a real tug of war over John Candy and specifically, and he didn't quite know what to make of it, and eventually he did go back to Second City.
Well, after years of obituary writing, I think last year a lot of television critics withdrew their obituaries, and now they're writing them again for Saturday Night Live. And I know you haven't gotten to see all the shows in the schedule, but it's interesting that Lorne Michaels is producing it again. And like the first time around, he got people who were totally unknown, but this time... Well, I'm sorry, with the exception of a couple of people.
That's right.
Whose names, I forget, just the real young one and the older one.
The Quaid
Randy
brothers.
Quaid.
Randy,
Quaid,
yeah.
Randy or Dennis?
It's Randy.
It's Randy,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And but anyway, so most of them are unknown, and they are not catching on at all, which for anyone who thought that Lorne Michaels had this incredible wizardry to choose people from out of nowhere who could be brilliant stars, he's really failed this time around.
Well, this is something that we're very sensitive about, because it's awfully... I agree that the show hasn't been funny, but they're trying, and it's awful easy to say that somebody is failing and, this is terrible. And television is often criticized for not giving people enough time and a chance, and I would hesitate to... campaign for them to be taken off the air. As Jeff has said, I think they're trying new things, and yes, they're struggling. But I don't really blame them, and I don't. No one has to watch.
It's also a myth, actually, that the first show got off the ground running at top speed, and that all these people became overnight sensations. Probably at the same time, back in 1976, at the spring of the first year. The only person who had broken out was Chevy. The others were still unknown. Even within NBC, there's a story about how one of the NBC publicists couldn't even remember one of their names, and the ratings weren't really that good back then, and they didn't really break out until much later on, even a couple of years later. And so it might be a little bit premature.
A couple of things. We only have a couple of minutes left. Nearly everyone from Saturday Night Live has had film careers, with the exception of Jane Curtin, who now has a very successful sitcom, and Gilda Radner and Lorraine Newman, Gilda had the Gilda Live Move Me, and Lorraine Newman was in Perfect, but they've hardly been seen. I'm sorry, Gilda Radner was in a few movies.
She's made movies
yeah.
with
and
her
I haven't
husband,
even
Gene
seen
Wilder.
Them, so they don't even much
yeah,
exist
they weren't,
to
no, they
me.
Weren't,
that's why
no,
I said
they've been
that.
Unsuccessful.
Yeah.
Not many people did see them.
So for the people like her and Lorraine Newman, who haven't had these wildly successful careers afterwards, how do they both look back on their years at Saturday Night Live? Do you know?
Well, we don't know Well, I know I can talk about Lorraine's feelings as she spoke to us about them, and she found it very difficult for many years to accept the fact that she wasn't a blazing success after the show. She does now, however, seem to be getting some success as a character actress, which I think she deserves. Gilda wouldn't talk to us, and our feeling and as to why that was that she's so sensitive about the firestorm that she went through on that show that she doesn't want to think about it anymore and certainly doesn't want to talk about it.
Who else wouldn't talk to you?
Dan Aykroyd would not talk to us. I think it's, again, for the very similar reasons. It was a very tense time for him. It holds a lot of bad memories, and just didn't want to dredge them up again. Especially after John died. And Chevy gave us a lot of time. Lorraine gave us most of a day.
Garrett didn't want to
Garrett talk.
Did not we actually talk. Ran into him in Los Angeles. Jeff saw him in a locker room in a place we were staying out in Los Angeles, and we had written him letters. And Jeff asked him, and he said, "Garrett, we'd like to talk to you about the show." What did he say? He was very angry.
Well, I can't quote him, but his response was one of anger. He just didn't want to hear about it. And these people are very sensitive about it. The writers and many of the backstage people were, very, very open, very open.
In a couple of seconds, because we're running out of time, one of the great successes of Saturday Night Live was that the network took a chance on a very risky, expensive new idea, and it paid off like crazy for them. Do you think that the success of Saturday Night Live has encouraged more risk-taking at the network level, or maybe it doesn't work that way? Very briefly.
I don't think it does work that way, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's a bottom-line business television.
Okay, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us, and my guests have been Jeff Weingrad and Doug Hill, the co-authors of the new book Saturday Night, A Backstage History of Saturday Night Live, and the book has just been published by Morrow. It's called again Saturday Night. It's 5:02, All Things Considered is coming up at 5 from National Public Radio. I'll tell you about tomorrow afternoon show after we check in with Shadow Traffic.
Checking traffic on the Schuylkill Expressway this afternoon. 15-minute delays in either direction through the reconstruction area. North of 95, some slowness around the Betsy Ross Bridge, some police activity on the shoulder. Major problems right now on the eastbound lanes of Vine Street. Jam from the area of the Schuylkill Expressway all the way across the Ben Franklin Bridge. An earlier disabled bus is the problem there. You'll also find jam traffic on all the numbered streets approaching both Race and Vine this afternoon. Also a problem up on the Lincoln Drive, closed in both directions between Wissahickon Avenue and Gypsy Lane because of an overturned fuel truck. Jam traffic there. That's Shadow Traffic. I'm John Butterworth on WHYY.
That Shadow Traffic Report was funded by Superfresh. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by novelist Kurt Vonnegut. And then Thursday afternoon at 4 o'clock, my guest will be Sir Alec Guinness, who will talk about his stage and screen career. This Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock on Fresh Air, we'll be joined by Canadian novelist Margaret Atwood. This Sunday at 6 o'clock on the Best of Fresh Air, my guest will be Chuck Barris, who will discuss the world of TV game shows in which he created and produced The Dating Game, The Newlywed Game, and The Gong Show. So I hope you can be listening. That about does it for today's program. If you have any questions or comments about Fresh Air, I hope you'll write to us at Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's 150 North 6th Street, 19106. Jay Goldman and Dan Lachlan were the engineers for today's show. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller co-produces the show. My name's Terry Gross. I want to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a very good evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay
good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Susan Stamberg.
Yeah, this is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
I said, "Mr. President, I'm not bound by diplomatic restraints. I'm talking only for myself, but I think you should cut and cut cleanly."
And the cut has been made. The Marcos rule is over in the Philippines. The U.S. recognizes the government of new Philippine President Corazon Aquino.
Tonight in All Things Considered, celebration.